It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And we want to welcome Cecil Harvell, who's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Cecil. Let's Talk Legal.
Good morning. How are you?
Hey, I'm very good. And Wes Collins is in studio here, so the gang is all together. What's our topic of discussion today, gentlemen?
Well, good morning again,
good morning,
Mike. Wes and I this morning want to talk about when is it required that a contract be in writing, and what is a writing? Can you believe that we would ask such a question as in what is a writing?
Yeah.
But contracts in the state of North Carolina is the subject today. Oral contracts, verbal contracts, written contracts. Let's kind of decipher some of this, and begin. And also, there are certain evidentiary rules that, of course, Wes will discuss with us as to supplementing, you know, a contract or a written contract, oral contract. Those are the kind of things we want to talk about today.
Yeah.
You know, Mike, folks agree to certain things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sell you my car. I'm going to sell you my, you know, used washer and dryer. I'm going to, you know, purchase your lawnmower. The list kind of goes on and on. I'm going to replace the gutters on your home. You know, thousands and thousands of different contracts occur every day. And many, many times these contracts are oral or verbal.
Mm-hmm.
They are not necessarily reduced to writing into a formal contract. Even an agreement to buy or sell a business, even more substantive things, buying and selling business, buying and selling real estate. Sometimes these things are not reduced to writing, and they are verbal. And in the state of North Carolina, I'll let Wes take over now, but the general rule of thumb, believe it or not, Mike, is that contracts do not have to be in writing. It certainly helps when they are, because it makes it more clear what the terms of the contracts are. But contracts generally, the general rule in the state of North Carolina, is that they do not have to be in writing. That's the general rule. And, of course, as we know on this program, we start with the general rule, and then we have the exception. And probably the biggest exception is the fact that a contract touching and concerning real estate in the state of North Carolina, that contract must be in writing.
Okay.
That is known in the law as the statute of frauds, right, Wes?
That's correct, yep. There's several other elements of that. Frankly, I had to look it up this morning because there's three or four of them that we use all the time, and three or four, or maybe two or three, that you don't use that often.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Cecil's absolutely correct. You know, folks generally think that, you know, if there's a contract, it has to be in writing. That's kind of like just the default that people think, but that's not true. You really just, in order to have a contract, you need to have an offer and acceptance and consideration, meaning we bargained for something.
Yeah, reach an agreement.
Right. So in most of the contracts that we see that end up in court, we were talking about litigation involving contracts are going to be things like an offer to purchase and contract real estate where maybe a party breached,
mm-hmm.
Promissory notes where money is owed, that type of thing, lease agreements, although in many cases lease agreements, rental agreements do not have to be in writing. Sometimes you see contracts with regard to the sale of something, but that's pretty rare. But generally, you know, when you're talking about a breach of contract and you're talking about the obligations and duties of the contract, you know, generally we have to talk about the document itself, and we have to talk about, is it enforceable? Does it fall within the statute of frauds? And then look at, you know, what it means. So sounds really basic, but it can get confusing.
Yeah, real fast.
Yep.
It's a man's word, a handshake. If I say, Wes, I'd like to buy that basketball, you know, rim, and we agree to a price, we shake a hand. That has standing in court? I mean, our verbal agreement and our handshake?
If it's $500 or more, it doesn't. That's one of our statute of frauds.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So, but who's going to go to court over less than $500?
Sure.
So, you know, you're not going to see that even in small claims court,
yep.
You know, very much. But kind of going through the list here as far as what contracts and type contracts have to be in writing. Of course, we kind of know this. Most people generally understand that, you know, a prenuptial agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, contracts dealing with marriage, that has to be in writing. A prenuptial agreement, postnuptial agreement, those type of things. These type of contracts are really important these days, too. We deal with them very often at Harvell and Collins as it relates to not only issues in the event of a divorce, but probably just as important, if not more important, issues involving rights in the event of the death of the spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're in a second or third marriage situation, potentially children from a previous marriage,
sure.
We really want to make sure that we address that elective share issue that we've talked about quite frequently on the program. So, and there's other issues as well, such as a spousal $60,000 spousal allowance. And what that is really is, let's not let the state of North Carolina dictate what the rights of the surviving
right.
spouse is. Let's decide what we want that to be based on our estate plan.
Mm-hmm.
Putting it in our will, trust, whatever we may do, because, you know, it could be that the marriage only lasts a very short period of time and someone, one of the two passes away. And then obviously we have rights that vest immediately upon the, mm-hmm. upon the marriage. So those obviously have to be in writing. Contracts that cannot be performed within 1 year, don't see that very often because in many cases a contract can be performed in a year. That could be a particular type of long-term lease or something
sure.
like that.
Big development.
In writing. As Cecil indicated, contracts with regard to the transfer of property, a handshake deal over the sale of real estate is not enforceable. Statute of frauds applies, and you have to have a writing in order for those agreements to be enforceable. And normally in the real estate, the realtor world and real estate world, the term that we use is the offer to purchase and contract, because that's that, you know, it's kind of a weird term, mm-hmm. offer to purchase and contract. Why isn't it just a contract? Well, it's because this is an offer to purchase
mm-hmm.
until the other party accepts it, signs it, then it's a contract. Okay, so that's somewhat of a realtor form type document that the North Carolina Board of Realtors, I think that's the right term for them, Board of Realtors puts in place and changes periodically with regard to the rights and obligations of the parties in a contract.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one as well.
How elaborate do these contracts between individuals have to be, Wes? Do they have to be witnessed?
Well, that actually, Mike, is where I wanted us to go right now.
Thank you. Okay.
The general rule is what we're talking about, that contracts do not have to be in writing. Most do not. And then there are these few exceptions where they must be. And so the issue that comes up, which, of course, someone like Wes in the litigation world has to deal with on an everyday basis, is that when there's been a lawsuit concerning a contract, and maybe there isn't something really clear in the contract, even though there might be some indicia of writing, if you will, maybe there isn't any writing at all, you know, is Wes, as the litigation lawyer, able to present certain memorandum or certain notes or certain, you know, what are you able to admit so as to prove the contract and the terms of the contract? So that's kind of what you were asking as well, Mike, mm-hmm. in a little bit of a different way.
Yeah.
Right. So that carries us over. And just there's two more on the list, and then I'll go into this issue
okay.
as far as it has to be in writing. When an executor agrees to pay the debt of an estate with his own money, don't see that very often, but that's not enforceable against the executor unless it's in writing. And then when one party becomes a surety, that means that they agree to pay the debt of another in the event that that the other doesn't pay it.
Yeah.
That has to be in writing. So again, the ringleaders with regard to those, the statute of frauds is going to be obviously contracts for the purchase of property, signed contract by the parties, and for goods of $500 or more. So those are kind of the ones that you see, you know, very often, and also prenuptial agreements.
Sure.
You know, those type things. But Cecil brings up a good point. You know, if you have an ambiguity in the contract, we have a written contract, we have an ambiguity, what do you do? Well, first of all, the judge, the court, makes a determination as to whether there is an ambiguity. Okay? If a contract is clear, it's easy to interpret, not necessarily easy to interpret, but it's clear as to the meaning. Yeah. And sometimes you have certain terms that are defined by other cases. So we know there are terms of art that apply. We know what this contract or this particular term means because this is well established in the law, for example. But if there's an ambiguity as determined by the judge, that's what we call a legal question, meaning the judge makes that determination.
Right.
A factual question would be one that the jury decides, okay, or the mm-hmm. finder of fact. If there's an ambiguity, then parole evidence is allowed to come in so that the jury can then determine what the true intent of the parties were with regard to the ambiguous term.
Mm-hmm.
That parole evidence could be testimony. Likely it would be. This is what we meant. This is what he said. If it falls outside the rules regarding hearsay, this is... this is the evidence that would indicate what the parties meant when they used this ambiguous term. So the jury could have more information. But the parole evidence rule is a very stern rule as it relates to contracts that are clear on their face and don't have an ambiguity. So that you just have to read the language in the contract and that language in the contract, as expressly stated in its four corners from beginning to end, is what the intent of the parties was, not what somebody said so-and-so meant. So I guess one of the things that we would say on the program this morning about that would be make sure you read and you understand what you're signing,
mm-hmm.
you know, before
yeah.
you sign it.
Right.
Because at some point in time, we might be looking at it in court determining
what the intent was.
What the heck was going on here.
Yeah.
And even you wouldn't be able to, let's say, you know, the person's living. The person can come in and potentially testify, that's not what I meant. Well, if the contract is clear, party can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Person cannot do that because the parole evidence rule would keep that evidence out. You're bound by the four corners of the language in the contract, and that is the agreement. And that's it. And we don't allow further evidence to come in with regard to that.
Is it dangerous for two individuals to draw up a contract on their own without getting legal counsel? It seems like it would be a small expense to get Harvell and Collins' fingerprints on a contract and get it stated clearly without any ambiguity.
Well, it depends on what we're dealing with. You know, Mike, we deal with a lot of for Eastern North Carolina, I would say relatively large business transactions dealing with maybe real property involved,
mm-hmm.
asset purchase agreements with regard to corporations, even stock purchase agreements, those type of things. Those type of deals have to be in writing. I mean, and that does, there's a little expense with regard to that, but that is money very well spent.
Yeah, it sounds
like
it has
to be done in writing. But if it's a very simple, low-value transaction, maybe dealing with something of personal property or something that's easy to interpret.
Piece of equipment, maybe, right?
Yeah, something like that. In many cases, you really don't even have to have a written contract. I mean, you're probably going to have a bill of sale
mm-hmm.
that's going to show, obviously, so you can transfer a title if it's something that's titled. But, if the money is changing hands and the seller is actually receiving the money for the piece of equipment and you receive that money and then you transfer title, then the deal is done.
Yeah.
So it comes down to how simple or complicated the transaction would be.
Okay.
But if you get into any level of value, any level of complication, you know, I would certainly recommend to at least consult with an attorney, and maybe the attorney would tell you that it's not necessary to have a written contract in this particular deal, or maybe the attorney would say, whoa, you really do need to have a contract, and here's why.
Yeah, if you're getting more complex.
If you're dealing with any kind of deal, which we try to stay away from, like a seller finance type deal, but if you're dealing with any kind of financing on anything, well, that means there is a certain level of value there,
mm-hmm.
okay, because the buyer can't pay for the whole thing at
sure.
once. Then certainly you would need an attorney to paper that up for you, as we say.
Yeah, very good. Let's take a break on that note, gentlemen, and we'll come back and we'll continue our conversation with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. If you'd like to have a conversation with Harvell and Collins, simply call 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back after this quick timeout. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Cecil Harvell on the phone and Wes Collins in studio. We're talking about contracts. Gentlemen, let's continue the conversation. Cecil?
I think an answer
I didn't know
to
who was going
to
talk.
Yeah, I think Mike, in answer to your question about kind of where do you draw the line in consulting with a lawyer, I think a lot of folks have kind of a sixth sense about that. We have lately been extremely busy in the area of contract writing and contract negotiation. We've had, you know, quite a few commercial matters where businesses either are being sold, and that might also include real estate, certain high-end products like, you know, large boats and things of that nature. We've had a lot of construction, as we know, here in eastern North Carolina, and a lot of construction issues and contract writing pertinent to different construction issues. And so it's been, the economy kind of drives this issue in a big way as well, because when the economy is really moving and grooving, then there's going to be more contract writing and contract reviewing by lawyers like ourselves. There are a lot of little, there's this big word in the contract world known as contingency.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, I'll perform and do the following, but only if the following occurs. And of course, in real estate contracts, some of the biggest contingencies, as we all know, are contingent upon building inspections, engineering reports, of course, there being a clear title to the property on land transactions. So it's hard to talk about today's program without also talking about certain contingencies.
Mm-hmm.
And when a contract goes south and there's a breach of contract in some way, even if it's an oral or a verbal contract, I'm sure that Wes will agree that, you know, the issue in the courts is and in the depositions, well, but you didn't do this. This was supposed to happen before that occurred. There's always kind of a contingency issue out there. Don't you agree, Wes?
Well, there is, and there's also the the requirement that in the event that you are in breach of a contract, you don't have any rights to sue under the contract and seek recovery.
Right.
So, you know, the contingency part of a contract, you know, is very important. You know, another area of contracts that folks do end up dealing with that I think that people don't really realize what their options are when they get into construction contracts, whether it be for the construction of a house or an improvement or whatever it may be, when dealing with general contractors, there are different types of contracts that we see in those type situations, and they're very important. For example, you could have a flat fee contract. And the flat fee contract is going to have specific provisions as to what the entire scope of work is going to cost. This is the flat fee. It won't go over that amount, but this is the scope of work, and there has to be a lot of detail there. We need to know, you know, obviously have plans with regard to the house and know what the finishes are going to be and know what, you know, the different elements that are going to go into the house are going to be. There will be normally a schedule of what your allowances are. This is how much money you have for cabinets. This is how much money you have for
fixtures.
Yeah. This is how much money that the framing is going to be, so on and so forth. And in the event that any of those line items go over, then potentially, based on the terms of the contract, then that flat fee would go up. So you have those type contracts. Probably the most common type of construction contract is what we refer to as a cost-plus contract, which is, okay, these are the costs, and then it's plus a percentage, normally somewhere between 15 and 20%. You'll also have allowances on in those type contracts so that we know that, you know, this is what we're basically basing it off of. This is what we think that we'll spend on cabinets. This is what we'll spend on flooring, so on and so forth, framing. But just as generally as an estimate, but in the event that the cost, in fact, are higher than that, then the construction overall cost to the owner is going to increase, you know, as well. So those are the two type contracts you normally see in the construction world. And if you do have that the flat fee contract, normally you're going to have language in the contract with regard to change orders. Mm-hmm. You know, in the event that there's a significant change, material change, then and that's going to change that flat fee number, then normally the parties will enter a change order. You normally don't see that in a cost plus contract because it's simply based on whatever the cost is. Now, it's important to note at the language in the contract what is included in the cost. Are the costs just the actual materials and the labor, or are overhead costs of the contractor also included? Okay, insurance related to the job, you know, these type things. So you've got to have those details. Otherwise, you can get it into a bit of a twist with regard to what you owe, and that always happens when? Right toward the end,
right
normally,
the
when
end.
You're ready to get in the house.
Yeah.
So
it's when Murphy moves in.
So, I think it's important in many cases, depending on the scope of the job, also to have legal counsel be involved in your construction contract because there's lots of twists and turns with those.
It's a good point, and it's a great topic to discuss today, Cecil. In the remaining about minute and a half we have left in today's show, I'll throw it over to you just to kind of wrap up today, if you could.
Well, I think the bottom line today is for our listeners to first understand that that contracts do not have to be in writing, generally speaking. A lot of folks just simply don't know that. I think that because everyone is touched usually by a contract concerning their home, which is in writing, they then make the assumption that other contracts have to be in writing as well because they recall that with regard to purchasing their home, there was a written contract. But generally speaking, but for the exceptions that Wes rattled off on the statute of frauds, a verbal agreement is absolutely enforceable in the state of North Carolina and can be enforced.
Yeah, I think that's important. I've learned a lot over this last 30 minutes. Wes?
Probably one last thing I would mention is in the event that you have been damaged as a result of a breach of contract, then the statute of limitations is normally going to be 3 years unless it's under seal, and then that extends it out to 10 years. Under seal means that it's sealed at the end, or the word S-E-A-L is at the end. So those time frames of 3 years and 10 years relative to when you would have to proceed in court are very important to know as well.
Yeah, you got to understand all the details in there because the devil is in the details. Gentlemen, thank you. And if you want to reach out to Harvell and Collins, do so today. Call 252-726-9050. Go online to harvellandcollins.com. Let's Talk Legal. We do it each Tuesday. We'll do it again next Tuesday. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Mike.